Welcome to the P3 Pilates Progressions Program, brought to you by Personalized Pilates. If you would like more information about the whole P3 program, please visit www.personalizedpilates.com. I'm Katrina So, your host for tonight. I'm a second-generation Pilates master teacher trainer, and I'm here to answer all your Pilates and anatomy questions so that you can take your Pilates teaching to the next level.
Hello. So tonight we have some really great questions. We've got a couple of different questions about the business side of working as a Pilates instructor, as well as some different client and Pilates questions. So I'm going to just jump right in, and we're going to start with the first question from instructor, and she wrote, I remember in the past podcast you talked about independent contractors and Pilates studios. Would you address how that might work? I am an independent contractor at the studio I teach at, but I don't have my own clients that I take to the studio. I teach that studio's clients. The studio takes care of all the billing and gross receipt taxes. I receive a check and I pay all my own taxes. I have a key to the studio. I open and close the studio on the days I work. I work after hours and on Saturdays because I have a full-time job outside of teaching Pilates. I can use the studio anytime I want for myself. I just need to clear it with the owner. I am interested in, quote, buying time at the studio in their off hours so I can practice some of the moves in our lessons on a third party. Parentheses, the other instructors are never available for me to practice on. I ask regularly. The studio owner and myself are trying to figure out how to make that work. The studio owner is concerned about the liability of the studio and the bookkeeping around invoicing me for the studio time, which I completely understand. How should I pay her to use the studio? I want to make a straightforward business transaction with the studio concerning this matter. This is an awesome question, and it is so complex. What it really comes down to is that this is a tax thing. Nobody really cares about this except for the IRS, okay? So you've got to make sure that you are following and obeying the tax laws, which it sounds like you and the studio are obeying the tax laws, but the IRS really wants to make a clear distinction between employee and independent contractor, and they have very specific guidelines that they go through. And basically, it's very specific and it's very not specific because every industry has different ways that they operate, and so it's hard to say it has to look like this. So they've got a whole bunch of guidelines and things that they use to look at to see if they can determine whether it's independent contractor or an employee. And basically, I'll quote my accountant, he said that, you know, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, they call it a duck. So you've got to take a look at what those are and see which kind of category you fall into. So I'm going to take a little bit and give you some of the top things that they look at specific to Pilates studios. Now, if you go through the IRS stuff, there's a lot of other qualifications that kind of don't pertain to us as much, but from my experience, these are the ones that matter the most for our industry. And I'll say this very clearly. This is a very serious issue. I have a friend who has a studio in L.A., and it's probably like a decade ago. She got an audit from the IRS, and they found that she was operating incorrectly, and she had thousands and thousands of dollars of back taxes to pay because she had been filing it incorrectly. She called them independent contractors, and they were actually employees according to the IRS's definition. So this is a really big thing, probably not as much for you as much as it is for the studio owner. So you might want to send her the link to this and let her listen to what I have to say directly. I'm totally fine with that. Just because I just hope that every studio owner can get it right because it's very tricky. And quite frankly, as studio owners, you don't want to pay thousands of dollars for accountants and legal fees just to figure out which way you're supposed to set it up. You know, you want to do what's going to work best for your business. And honestly, we have had a myriad of situations over the decades that we've been in business. I did start, it was just myself, so there was no issue. And then when I first hired some people, we started independent contractors. And then as it grew, We had some problems with that, which I'll address in a little bit. And then we switched kind of a format of independent contractors, and we eventually now have employees. So we've run the gamut of different ways of doing it for different reasons, and there's a lot of ways to do it. You can do it either way as applied instructor, so don't let anyone say you have to do it one way or the other. It just depends on how you want to operate your business, and then you have to pick which way you're going to structure it based on how you want to run your business, I would recommend. Now, the biggest problem comes is that most studio owners do, they call it one thing, but they're really operating the other way, and that's where you can get in trouble. And most of the time, they're treating them like employees, and they're calling them independent contractors because it's a lot easier to be an independent contractor, to have independent contractors. And what I mean by that is as a studio owner, you have less paperwork, you don't have to withhold taxes, and therefore it looks like you're paying your instructors more money. When you have employees, as the employer, you have to take out their taxes, which is a lot of paperwork, it's annoying, and it causes you to have them take home less pay at the end of the day because they don't have to pay the taxes. The taxes are already withdrawn. And quite frankly, for most people, they look at that take-home check and it's smaller, and they don't think about the fact that it's, oh, my taxes are already taken out for me. It's the same money. They look at it as my check is smaller. And so that's a really big negative for a lot of people that might want to work for you. Now, I'm going to go over some of the qualifications. I'm going to give you some different scenarios. So, if you have like a studio and the studio calls the instructors independent contractors, but they set the price they charge, they collect the payments, the instructor turns in maybe a timesheet or something, and then they get a check from the studio. They're working on the studio's equipment. They're limited in where else they can work and when they can work, and they're required to teach a specific method or style of Pilates. The instructors should carry their own liability insurance, and the clients are a mix of those the instructors developed and people that call the studio. This type of studio would get audited and be told their instructors are misclassified and need to be employees. So this is a classic example of what typically happens where studios get in trouble, the studio owner. Okay, so some of the things that I highlighted that the IRS looks at, they look at who sets the prices. This is huge. Does the studio set the price? That would be considered an employee. Does the independent contractor set the price? Does the instructor set the price? That would be considered an independent contractor. Another thing they look at, who collects the payments from the clients? Now, you can get around this, which we did for a little while, but typically if the studio is collecting the payments, the studio has employees. If they are working on the studio's equipment, usually it's an employees. But again, this is a classification that's kind of tricky for Pilates studio owners because obviously almost everyone uses the studio's equipment. That's why they're coming there. So in terms of this rule, usually it's more like does the studio supply things like business cards for them? So don't be giving out business cards with your studio's logo with all the different instructors' names and then say that it's an independent contractor. That would be a big red warning sign. If you do not allow them to teach other places, that's a huge one. And a lot of times studios don't want people to be working other places because they'll steal clients and, you know, whatever. And so they'll have them sign non-compete clauses. Again, this can be gotten around, but it's real sticky, and usually that is a sign that it's an employee. And then if they're required to teach a specific method, style of Pilates, lesson plan, order, any of that kind of thing, it's very much an employee. Some other things that fall into this category that I've seen over the years is if they have a specific dress code, especially if it's like a specific uniform, like a certain shirt you have to wear and stuff like that, that's an employee. If you have set hours, this is a big one, like, you know, you always are there from like 5 till 8 on Fridays or, you know, whatever, then that would definitely be an employee. especially if you're getting paid, whether you have a client or not. That's totally employee. But also to the fact that if you have to give notice of time off, you know, who is contacting the clients and who is determining whether you can cancel on them and such. That would be, if the studio has control, that's an employee. You know, if you have to, like, ask for, you know, time off ahead of time, that's usually more employee. Versus an independent contractor has the choice of whether they want to go to work that day, and they can cancel on their clients whenever they feel like it. Not a good policy, but it's the legal possibility and freedom that it gives them to do that. So there's some other little things like who is enforcing the cancellation policy. If the instructor chooses to let somebody, you know, oh, well, you know, your daughter's sick, so I won't charge you this time. If the instructor gets to decide that, it's more the independent contractor. If the studio decides that, it's more the employee. So there's a lot of different aspects to it, and it can be kind of tricky. A lot of times if it's the studio bringing clients or you bringing clients, either way, that can be gotten around, whether it's employee or independent contractor. But most places where the studio is bringing clients, they're going to want an employee situation because it's going to be more advantageous to them and it's going to protect them more in terms of their clients, that those clients are theirs. They paid the money to advertising to get them in, and, you know, the instructor cannot take with them the client and stuff like that. Another situation, so say you're brought in to teach a couple classes, you are provided the students, and the space is provided for you, but you're allowed to teach whatever you want that's appropriate for that class description. You carry your insurance, et cetera. This is really typical at like a gym, and especially this can go either way, and it's kind of an ongoing debate. The IRS tends to look at that more as an employee situation, though. If you were to, like, sign a contract just to teach for a semester or X number of classes or X number of months at this price, that could be looked at more of as an independent contractor because you're being hired for just a certain defined amount of time that's limited with a stated scope of practice and, stated scope of action and time. So it's a little bit more clear if it's a specific time frame. So that time frame thing can be an issue. So I wanted to give you some of those thoughts. As a studio owner, like I mentioned before, we started out, I'm just giving you my studio history so you can kind of see some different aspects and issues that come up. We started out and I was doing rental agreements per month. And I thought this was awesome because it totally gives the instructor, the way I had it set up, the benefit of if you get more clients, you're not necessarily even paying more money until you get to the next kind of tier. And so it made it very simplistic in terms of keeping track of records and stuff. It was very gracious if you had an extra client that you forgot to put on the books or, you know, whatever. It was very, very forgiving in that way. But for some reason, I found that the instructors did not like that as much. So then we went to an hourly where you had to give me, like the independent contractor had to give me, the studio owner, a written documentation of every student that they taught and the time they taught, and they paid a fee for each student. So you paid X amount for a private, you know, Y amount for a duet, you know, that kind of a thing. It did have to go on the schedule just so that there weren't any conflicts of like, oh, there's not enough reformers or something like that. But it wasn't that we were controlling it as a studio at all. At that point in time, the independent contractors, collected all the money. They could charge whatever they wanted. They brought in all their own clients. They were their clients. They could do whatever they wanted with their clients during the hour they were renting from us, and they just got to use our equipment. Great system. Very low maintenance in terms of a studio owner, meaning you're not having to collect all the money. You're not paying the credit card fees if they, you know, use credit cards. You don't have to hassle with the clients. You're not enforcing the cancellation policy. It's all the independent contractor. However, unfortunately, not everyone is as ethical as I would love to believe. And a lot of times instructors tend to have an attitude of, I'm doing all the work here because I'm doing the teaching and I should make all the money, which they don't a lot of times seem to get until they are on the business owner's side, how much money it costs to run the studio and keep the doors open and pay for the equipment and the upgrades and all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, they don't appreciate what their rent is paying for. And what we found was that, unfortunately, we had two major cases of fraud. One instructor we found not writing clients in the books and not, you know, she wasn't paying us for the clients. And we, you know, had multiple ways of seeing that there were clients coming in that she was not paying us for rent. And there was also some instances where we had some classes and she was collecting the money for us, for the classes and such, which, and then she was not turning it into the studio. So there's some weird things going on there. Because the instructors had access to the money, it gets sticky. You know, who's, you know, there's an honesty and integrity thing there. We also had another instructor who, she, while she was working at our studio and she was bringing her own clients, she's an independent contractor, she opened her own studio a couple blocks away, and she not only took her clients, which is fine, she's an independent contractor, but she was soliciting all the rest of our clients and took a number of them as well. Now, it all panned out and worked out in the end, but, you know, it's a sticky situation, and because the instructors were handling the money, it just gets very, very tricky. Now, this can be an awesome situation. We found that over the course of the years, we wanted to have more control of what was going on in the studio, more continuity of the instruction that was happening. We were growing and doing more marketing, so we were bringing in a lot more clients of the studios than myself and my husband could handle. And so most of the clients that were in the studio, it got to be where they were studio clients. They weren't the clients that the instructors were bringing in. So it kind of shifted. And so we shifted to where the instructor is not collecting the money. We, the studio, were collecting the money. We were doing all the scheduling. They were the studio's clients. They were not the independent contractor's clients. And we were having control over what they did and didn't teach. So if we wanted them to use a certain lesson plan, we could say that. If we wanted them to wear a uniform, we could say that. And we've taken those liberties, which, you know, not every studio wants to do that and wants to have that control, but we did. So it just kind of evolved as we evolved as a studio. So you can kind of hear from the different – oh, and so therefore we made them employees. Make sure I stated that. So we do take out their taxes and all that kind of stuff, which, again, is a lot more work on our part. But it for us, it was worth it to have the security of people not stealing from us, as well as having a little more being able to brand the studio and continuity of care at the studio with the teaching standards being more level and across the board, if that makes sense. So it just depends as a studio owner what you want. Now, that was kind of a more general answer. I wanted to get to the specific question, and I asked her, and she said no, she does not have any of her own clients. She would like to, though, and this is the issue, is that they don't have any kind of a arrangement for that. And I, right off the top of my head, that just seems very odd because usually independent contractors, that's the main thing that's in their original agreement is how much do I pay the studio for clients that I bring in? Okay, so, I mean, it sounds like this is a great scenario for you. You get to just walk in and have clients. I would definitely talk to this instructor, the studio owner, and figure out something about how you can pay rent for the clients that you bring in. And that's going to vary wildly on what she thinks is fair. Probably it's going to be about, oh, that's so hard. It depends on the area and what you're charging. So look at what you're getting paid now and what the client is paying. And that difference, what the studio is keeping, your rent should be about that or less. probably a little bit less because you're bringing the client in, so you're not there. The studio owner is not having to pay advertising and stuff. This is just extra money in her pocket. Now, in terms of liability, that is a very good question. This shouldn't really be a big deal because you should already have insurance for yourself as an instructor, and she should already have insurance for the studio. And if you don't have that, whether they're an employee or an independent contractor, you need to have that. That's very, very key. So the liability should not be an issue. Now, I'll tell you offhand, I know most studios do not have studio liability. They just have, most of them just require that the individual instructors have their own liability insurance. And you, of course, can get that through the PMA, through lots of different other companies and such. And it shouldn't cost very much, like $100, $200 per year kind of a thing. So it's not super expensive. This should cover if somebody gets hurt, Lord willing, it never happens. A lot of times what happens is they actually will sue the instructor, and they will also sue the studio. So both of you need to be covered regardless of whether you're an independent contractor or an employee. And this is something I've actually been looking at more because I'm actually being used as an expert witness on a case in Utah where there's issues, and there, of course, the client got hurt, and then they're suing the different companies that are possibly involved. And they're suing everybody possible. So it's kind of that's how it works. When somebody gets hurt, they look for wherever they can get some money. So I would definitely make sure you have that. As a studio owner, the studio coverage, obnoxious, and it's expensive. But it's definitely worth having if you want to protect yourself. So it shouldn't be any difference liability, and I would definitely think that the studio owner would want you to be able to bring in your own clients. It's just extra money for them. So just figure out what you guys think is a fair price. And it sounds like, and this may be wrong, that you want to practice your lessons and you're not allowed to do that on the clients that she is supplying you. Just so you know, that totally re-employee. Okay, so along with the they're collecting the money, it's all their clients, they're scheduling you, just a little hesitation there. Now, some of these details I may be getting wrong because I'm just going off of this little small paragraph that's written. It could be that you just don't think that the clients of the studio has supplied you are able to do some of those exercises, and you want to find some people that you know that can do them so you can practice teaching. That'd be a totally different situation. So, and that would be very, very understandable, especially since we cover the full repertoire in our lesson plans. One thing I would recommend, and I'm going to jump on this soapbox because it's such a big issue. We have people all the time that are whining about, I say whining lovingly, about having to stick to the lesson plans. And one of the main reasons that I have people stick to the lesson plans at all costs when they're in training is because if you don't, you won't get to learn how to modify them appropriately. So, yes, the exercises that are in lesson plans are hard. They're difficult. And a lot of them, the problem isn't that they're super difficult and not able to be modified. It's that the instructor needs to know how to modify them. And that in its basic level, it is hard, but there's a lot of ways to break it down and modify it. And that's what I want you guys to really focus on and really delve into. And we talked a lot about that in, I believe it was the personalization lecture, about all the different techniques to do that. And this is one of the things I really, really want to drill home with all the P3 people, especially when they're in training, is to really get versatile in being able to break any exercise down so that almost any client could do it or some part of it. I'm talking about even like snake or twist. Like, how could your beginning level client do some part of snake or twist? Okay, that takes some creativity, and being able to do that and think through that is going to make you an amazing instructor. It's going to help you understand the components of the exercise and what is needed to do the exercise. It's going to help you be more creative in how to break things down and how to teach things. This is such an invaluable skill, and I think this is probably one of the weakest areas for most instructors. Most instructors just, they rely on the fact that there's like 500 different exercises and they can just rest on their laurels of what they're comfortable with, and they just, well, they just stick with the basic exercises if they're a beginner. And they only get to do the snake or twist or any part of it if they're super, super advanced. And maybe they teach that once in their career. I'm not even kidding. So that's one thing I just want to encourage everybody about. That was a total rabbit trail. Nothing to do with independent contractors and their employees, but I just wanted to mention that because I think it's good to hear that lots and lots and lots, because everyone seems to kind of forget that. Okay, so set up some kind of written agreement about how you're going to rent space for your own clients coming in and how much you're going to pay to use the studio. And I think this would be awesome. If you have follow-up questions or if the studio owner has a question, please just send them to me and we will work on them. All right, so next question. Sure. Good morning, Katrina. I learned so much from the way you answered my question last week. The way you go through each step and explain your thought process helps me to learn those essential critical thinking skills necessary to become a more knowledgeable and intuitive Pilates instructor. You are welcome. To clarify one aspect of last week's question, I did mean that I pressed the distal medial aspect of my femur pressed together. I was thinking that by stabilizing the distal ends of my femur, since the proximal ends articulate with the pelvis, that this would help me keep my pelvis stable. For example, when I lay on the floor on my back, the weight of my pelvis on the floor becomes feedback for my pelvic stability. But when I am sitting or bending over, i.e. to take clothes out of the dryer, if I stabilize the distal end of my femur, then my SI joints aren't rotating as much because the strength and length of the femur itself helps keep the pelvis stable. I'm sure this is too convoluted to talk about in the air. I disagree. However, you said about the muscles of the upper inner thigh makes a lot of sense, and I have taken to bring a small ball with me in my purse. I use it at my desk or in my car when no one's around. Smiley face. I place the ball at the highest point of my inner thighs to get those muscles activated, and my body finds all this very interesting. This is great. I love this question. So I love that you guys are listening to the show and your questions getting answered and that you're sending me feedback. It's always good to know whether you have follow-up questions or I just cleared it all up. Even if it did clear it up, it's awesome to hear. Okay, so quick review. Last week we talked about she had some SI joint issues and she was doing some inner thigh work to try to stabilize the pelvis and stuff. And she was putting working on squeezing her thighs together down right above the knee, so the distal medial aspect. And I wasn't sure if she meant that or if she was confused with distal and proximal, because my recommendation would be to squeeze at the proximal medial, so high up on the inner thighs, like up by your crotch area. Okay, so everybody's pelvis works a little different, so I have a hard time telling you one size fits all. And for you, maybe squeezing at the distal end down by the knees would be better. Okay, so I want to give that big disclaimer there. So focus on your body and the feedback you're getting. Now, from my experience working with clients, and especially after being pregnant with different pregnancies, my SI joint has gotten wobbly. And I have found that to work on the higher part, way up by your crotch, activates more muscles and actually draws the SI joint into a more stable place, okay? If you are doing movement, like bending and such, your SI joint should move more because it should have some movement in there. Now, what we don't want is too much movement, and that's where you're getting problems. Anyone would get problems, especially if you're pregnant or have been pregnant in the past, because those ligaments tend to get a little loose. Which we talk about more in the pregnancy lecture. But, bending over to take clothes out of the dryer, play with anytime you bend over, whether you're doing hamstring stretch one or getting clothes out of the dryer, doesn't matter. Any kinds of things, I find it easier to do when I'm doing Pilates because I'm more focused mentally, but it doesn't really matter. They're the same actual movements. Try it, thinking about the lower distal area, by your knees, squeezing together, and then try it with the upper top of the thighs, squeezing together, and see which one feels more stable and better to you. See which one irritates you the next day. And that's going to be the best discernment. Okay, now in terms of bringing the small ball, I would recommend focusing on the small ball in the studio. I think that at your desk and in your car is an awesome place. But what I have found is that it's really interesting to start working with it while you're doing other exercises. So here's an example. One of my favorites is the roll-up. Okay, and I pick on this one because especially after I have had a baby, assuming I have no diastasis, which has not always been the case, I find that the roll-up is ridiculously hard. And that's kind of one of my telltale exercises to see how out of shape I still am by how well I can do a roll-up, if that makes sense. And one of the big things is, again, that SI joint tends to get loose and wobbly. My inner thighs are not doing what they're supposed to be doing as much because I've had different stresses on my body. And so I will put that ball, like, up in my crotch between my thighs and squeeze it, okay, while I'm doing a roll-up. And you'll notice that certain hard part to get the waistband down where you're, like, halfway up, halfway down, that's the spot that you can't hold on to the ball. To the point where if I do something like this, like, say, the roll-ups when you're laying down on the reformer, the ball will fall down through the springs for clients. Okay, I'm usually too smart to do that to myself. I don't want to have the embarrassment of the ball falling through. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm just saying in all actuality, even if you're doing one on the mat, you'll see that widen apart. And this is why a lot of times people, you'll see them, they can't keep their legs together on the roll-up. This is the connection, okay? And it's from the really high inner thighs. There's a lot of muscles like the pectineus and stuff that are up there and adductor brevis and everything. Because that's a really important area. Anytime you see multiple muscles doing the same exact thing, it's just like a huge alert. This is an important motion. Pay attention to it. So watch for that and see if you have those same weak spots that I do after babies. Okay, so hopefully that, I think putting it between your thighs when you're doing other things is great as well. You can multitask, and I'm a huge fan of multitasking. What you'll find also is that, I think I mentioned this before, but eventually you won't need the ball. The ball is just to give you something to feel, that physical contact will give you some tactile feedback as to whether or not you're really getting it and how intense you're getting it. Now, if you had like a blood pressure cuff kind of thing, you could get an actual number on it. You totally don't need to do that. You'll feel it on the ball, and you'll notice when you get to that spot where you're like in the movement where you can't hold the ball, and you'll know that's the spot that I need to work on. Probably won't shock you too much, but it is a fun thing. Okay, I am going to move on to another question. This is another business side of the equation question. All right, so she wrote, I was thinking of advertising as currently I'm just using word of mouth. Which method do you think is better? Radio or newspaper? There are 3 radio stations here and 2 newspapers. One is free, delivered weekly. I'm not sure the cost of the radio advertising, but it's approximately $3.50 for the newspaper, in which I would get a write-up every third week and a business card printed weekly in the health section for 3 months. My other question is that what I say in my ad, I have to think of the town. It's small, and people have only heard of Matt Pilates. Do I just talk about what Pilates will do? Do I talk about my qualifications? It seems they wouldn't know what they are unless they Google them, Do I talk about the health insurance rebate they might get? How can I hook people? I offer the first lesson free since people don't know what I do. Any thoughts would be greatly appreciated because I only see myself paying for advertising once and using word of mouth hereafter. Okay, so lots of different thoughts. First off, I just want to say about the health insurance rebate. This question comes from one of our P3 people that is in Australia, so that, you know, doesn't relate to U.S., and just in case you were wondering, what in the world is she talking about? That sounds fabulous. First off, I don't recommend radio or newspaper. Now, this could be different in your area, so I want to put a big caveat there. I don't live in Australia. I've actually never been there, although I love to go. I hear it's beautiful. But my experience shows that really the best method is the internet. In today's world, that's where everybody looks. at least the people that have money enough to do it. I don't know if that sounds terribly snobby or what. I did, at the very beginning of my career, put an ad in a very high-end magazine in Phoenix there. It's just a local magazine that was very catering to the rich-end clientele. And I thought, oh, this is a great demographic, yada, yada. I got zero responses from it. Zero, none, nothing. Gorgeous ad, super expensive, laid out a lot of money for it. Totally thought I'd get at least one or two clients to, you know, at least cover my costs and stuff. But nothing, yeah. Totally annoyed and disappointed and just felt like a total stupid person for doing this. You know, if it's only $350, maybe it'd be worth it. It's still a lot of money. I could think of a lot of things I could do for $350. So that's my thought. I would focus on making sure that you have a good website, one that looks professional and that has good SEO. So that's search engine optimization. And both are important. A lot of people, they go out to make a website and they just focus on the aesthetics. Aesthetics really don't matter that much. As long as it's functional, people can really understand how to find the information they want. And as long as they can find the website, you know, if they have a hard time finding the website when they type in your name and Pilates or your address or your town name and Pilates, you got problems. You should be like the first one, if not, you know, more. But you want to have them come up when they don't know who you are and stuff. So what this means is that you need to find either a friend or family member that knows how to do building websites. That I say because it's a lot cheaper, probably. You can maybe have a client that can do trades for you. Or you can do what I did and go online and figure it out. So I would recommend WordPress. WordPress is, I'm sure there's probably other website building tools that are easier to use. I don't find WordPress to be super difficult, but there's tons of videos out there on YouTube and such, and you know, you can Google almost anything you need on WordPress and you'll find information about it. It's a very, very huge platform. But the big thing is that they have a lot of tools on there that you can use to make it search engine optimized. And that is a big term that just means that Google will find you. And that's your key thing because you don't want to have to pay for advertising. You want it to come up what they call organically so that if people are looking for Pilates in your area or, you know, they have back pain and stuff, you know, the keywords are going to trigger that search engine to bring you up, not because you had to pay for it. And in the long run, if you spend a little more time and energy at the front end getting a good website, it's going to serve you really well in the long run. And it's going to go a lot farther than any radio or newspaper ad is ever going to go because it's still there. You know, it doesn't go away. I mean, you can make updates and stuff, and it's no big deal, and you can keep it current. And then in terms of all this what to say, you can say all of it. You should say all of it. You should have a very thorough, put lots of information. The more information you put on there, the easier it's going to be for them to find. Now, if you're still convinced that you should do radio or newspaper, you want to keep it simple. You want to focus on how it's going to help them. Get them hooked in. So in terms of what Pilates is going to do, and if you have health insurance rebates, that would be a good thing. So they may have heard that it's expensive. If you have something like that, that would be a good hook. I wouldn't necessarily talk about your qualifications because, like you said, they're not going to really know what it is, and it's going to take a lot of time to explain them. You might want to say, you know, certified Pilates instructor, or, you know, something to make you sound official, but keep it really brief. As much as I would like you to brag about how you're a P3 graduate and all this stuff, they don't know. They don't probably know much of anything, especially if it's an area where, you know, they've only heard of mat Pilates, if that. Right, when I first started out, people would be, what? They hadn't even heard of mat Pilates because it was before Mari Windsor was all popular, so it was, you know, even a harder battle. But now at least they know mat Pilates. You can talk about how you have all the equipment and everything and how, you know, you can make it infinitely harder, easier, and you're trained to, personalize it to exactly what they need and that kind of thing. And that would be a big thing is to mention that the first lesson's free. Who can resist free, right? And once they try it, they'll probably love it as usual. So those would be the hooks I would use. And again, that would be the same focus I would use on a website in terms of the opening, front page kind of a thing. You want to focus on beautiful pictures. And, be careful on pictures that you don't steal other people's pictures and things like that, or copy and paste their descriptions of Pilates. I've seen all sorts of terrible stuff. You want to write your own material and have your own pictures. Sometimes, that can be a big problem. If you want nice, professional-looking photos and you don't have them, instead of, stealing them off of Balanced Body's website or something, what you want to do is go to stock photography websites and you can buy them, okay? And then you have the rights to use them as much or wherever you want, whether it's something print or on your brochures or on your website. Another great idea is to have a friend that's a photographer or that's just good at photography and have them come in and take some pictures of you. You can use a white screen. There's tons of great, easy-to-use software that you can white out the background or make sure the tint of the lighting is right and everything. So you don't have to pay a fortune to have good photos. You just want to be smart how you do it. And, of course, as you grow, you can always get better photos later. I started out with stock photography, and then I had photos that, my husband took of me, and, they weren't great. And then, we got a good photographer who actually is a client, and she does fabulous work for us. And it's great because, if we want to do trades or things like that, we can do that. So there's ways to do it without dropping thousands of dollars on some of these things, the way people's first inclination might be. Hopefully that helps in terms of what some ideas. Again, I can't emphasize the importance of a good website. Maybe spend a little bit more on WordPress to get a nice template to start instead of the free templates. It's going to be a lot easier to use. You can there's all these things called widgets and things that you can upgrade your WordPress site to as you go. Not now, but maybe later to do fancy things and all sorts of stuff. So it's got a lot of flexibility to customize it to exactly what you want. And you can, again, you'll be in charge of changing the content, so you can do whatever you want, whenever you want. And it's always there. So fabulous. So those are my thoughts. Embrace the web. It is fabulous. Very important. Okay. Let's see. It is getting towards the end of our show, and I do have a caller. So if you wanted to ask a question, just let me know. And by pushing, I believe it's number 1, to show that you have a question, okay? You might just be wanting to listen in, and I'm not sure. So I'm going to go ahead and read the next question. Oh, they do have a question. I'm going to get you. Here we go. Hello, you are live on the air.
Hi, Katrina. This is Jerry.
Hey, how are you doing, Jerry?
Hi, I'm doing fine. Can you hear me okay? Because I'm on my earbuds, and I'm plugged into my phone.
I can. You sound crystal clear. So do you have a question for us tonight?
Right. Yes, I do. I have a question. I've been teaching a mat Pilates class, just a half an hour class at the school that I work, because our school district is doing a wellness initiative, a wellness push. And so I've been, just teaching basics and working into getting, I have a nice average of 15 to 20 women. We haven't been having any of the men come, any of the teachers, but the women love it, and they're doing really well. And then I have one student who is, at the end of every class, she just said that she gets a headache. By the end of the class, she has a headache, but it's but it just goes away. Like she said, she just gets in her car and everything, she gets home, she takes up her kids, and then by the time she gets home, it goes away. And so have you ever heard of, I think she's whole. I asked her about holding her breath. She said she'd pay attention. I asked her about drinking water. I asked her about other things. And she's, so she's just like, oh, it's Pilates class, time for a headache, I'm like, great.
Oh.
But she loves it, so she doesn't want to stop. And so I just was, if you had, any other ideas or anything about, that's just odd to me.
Yeah, well, there's a whole bunch of things. So I'm going to go through a whole bunch of different things, and you can maybe talk to her about some of these and see.
Okay.
I think you're right on. Okay. I think you're right on about the dehydration. That can be an issue. Sugar levels, if they haven't eaten in a long time, that can be an issue. If they're jumping in, doing too much too fast, like if they're never exercising and they're going gung-ho on your new Pilates class, probably with Pilates, that's not going to be the issue. That would probably be more if, like, they're doing crazy aerobic stuff. Another thing, there are different types of headaches and such that can contribute. So there's like exertional headaches, and then there's effort migraines, and it's kind of hard to tell the difference between the two, and you're not a doctor that I know of, so probably it's completely outside of your scope. But a lot of these, let's see, the exertional headache, I'll go through them. They tend to be recurrent, but eventually they'll tell you to use like non-steroidal drugs, which again I would disagree with. The effort migraines, again, migraines can be associated with a lot of other things like hormones and different supplement deficiencies and stuff. And this can sometimes be gotten rid of with more gradual warm-up and stuff. There's also vascular headaches, which people are pretty familiar with, which, you know, tend to come on when you're doing something like running and it's like high altitude, heat, dehydration, that kind of stuff where you just get overheated and stuff. Probably not that. One thing I would ask her about is maybe if she's low in magnesium. And I was going to talk about this because with especially the effort migraines, migraines are really associated with magnesium, and magnesium is a huge, huge supplement that most people tend to be a little deficient in. They load up on calcium and stuff, but they don't realize that magnesium is a really important one, and it has a whole bunch of issues. So the headaches is one, but on another line, the low magnesium can cause a lot of muscle spasms and cramps. I'll tell you, I've noticed a extreme correlation in myself between low magnesium and plantar fasciitis. I actually got some plantar fasciitis earlier this year, and it wasn't a muscle imbalance, as I usually would tell people, but it was a magnesium deficiency, that when I started taking the magnesium, it just kind of melted away. And I say that because usually we see muscle cramps and stuff or hear about them in the studio as well. It can also play into anxiety and depression, high blood pressure, hormone problems. With the pregnant clients, they get the calf cramps and stuff. It can deal with low energy, sleep problems, bone health, like all sorts of stuff. That would probably be one that I would look at real early on for her, especially if she is hydrated and, you know, not taking it too much. I wouldn't worry too much, although, you know, of course she might want to get it checked out by a doctor, the headaches and stuff. But probably it's something not super, super, like, scary. If she did want to take a magnesium supplement, I highly recommend one called Natural Calm, and it's by Natural Vitality. It's a effervescent one, and it's actually made with stevia, and the thing is that most of these supplements, there's so much other gunk in the supplements, whether it's sugar or like silicone and just weird things that are, you know, carcinogenic and stuff, that you want to be careful. And I find this one is very effective, and it doesn't have anything funky in it, so to speak. So I don't have any kickbacks. It's not a thing that I'm getting anything for. I just really like that supplement, and I found it to be very helpful.
All right. Well, I think it fits what you're saying about the magnesium, because I know that she's been asking me about cramps as well. Was maybe that combination?
Great.
Yeah, that's another. You know, and so
not
that's
great
a really
that she has cramps.
Yeah. Yes. You know, like in her feet. You know, like, you know, so when she points her toes and then she straightens them, you know, like the Dorsian plantar flexion, then she's like,
right,
her toes get crampy and stuff. Yeah. So that's really good. That's a great
idea.
And plus, I'm sitting here drinking my glass of Natural Calm as you're talking. I found that very
coincidental
and amazing. Yeah. That's crazy.
Oh, that's hilarious. So, yes, I'm not the only one.
Great. No, and it's so nice at night when you drink it and it helps you to sleep. For me, it just helps calm me down. So, okay.
Yep.
All right, well, those are really great. I'm going to make that suggestion to her then.
Yeah,
and then,
I'm going to give you guys
also,
some other – oh, you had another question. Go ahead.
No, it wasn't. I wanted to remind everybody to get on and give you a review so that your podcasts move up. You know how
bless you,
ask that? Because I went on and gave a review, and mine was the only review, so they can't even have an average yet. And, of course, they gave you a 5 because you deserve a 5. So we need to, like, have more people go in and do reviews. I just wanted a little short, like, you know, advertisement for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Jerry. Did you have any other questions?
No, that'll do it. Thank you so much, Katrina.
Oh, no problem. I'm going to talk a little bit more about magnesium, but I so appreciate your question because it brings up a really good point on the magnesium.
Okay, thank you. All right, good evening.
Thank you, Jerry. Yeah.
Uh-huh,
okay, so, yeah, you have a great night. So on the magnesium topic, I just want to say a couple other things that you might – I've heard a lot of people say that, oh, you should just have a banana. A banana is actually a good magnesium-rich food, but it's not the best one. One banana has about 32 milligrams of magnesium, which is a lot. But a cup of spinach has 157 milligrams, so way more. So I'm just going to go over real quick the top magnesium-rich foods. So spinach is number one, then chard. So those leafy vegetables are really good. Pumpkin seeds, yogurt or milk kefir, almonds, black beans, avocado, figs, and dark chocolate. And then bananas would be number 10. But the dark chocolate, this is a huge one I want to point out because a lot of times when women crave chocolate, what they're really craving is magnesium, and this is a huge thing. I know that after pregnancies, after I have the baby, labor, I almost always crave chocolate, and the whole process of that pushing the baby out really depletes the magnesium. Any huge physical exertion does. So, you know, you can see the connection there real quickly. I also want to mention that one of the best ways to get magnesium in, whether if you don't, you know, sometimes the effervescent might bother some people or they just don't like it, whatever. But one of the best ways is transdermally, and that's meaning through the skin. So there's something called magnesium oil that you can buy or make. It's actually super easy to make and much cheaper. It's called magnesium oil, but it's not an oil. This always made me laugh when I first found out. It's actually just magnesium dissolved in water. So it's not actually oily. All you do is you just spray it onto your body, and it will get into your skin. You can do other forms like lotions. You can make your own, or you can buy magnesium lotions. Again, they're super easy to make. And you can put them on your feet and have it go through your feet. You know, put it on before bed and then put some socks on over it or something. You could rub it on your stomach, whatever you want. But those would be good ways, especially if people know that they have, like, leaky gut or some kind of poor digestive absorption. And that would help them to still get their magnesium in. Or, if you have kids that don't want to take a supplement, although I think the Calm is almost like a, I don't know, it's I like it. My kids like it. You know, you could do this for picky kids or say they don't like the foods that I mentioned to get in. So there's lots of different ways to get the magnesium in. And magnesium is so, so important. It's got so many different issues that come with it that you really want to avoid. And there's a lot of discussion now about how osteoporosis, you know, everyone throws calcium on it. Calcium will actually make the magnesium deficiency worse when you have too much calcium. And a lot of times it's really hard to get the calcium to be absorbed if you don't have enough things like vitamin D and magnesium and such. So you want to make sure that it's not just calcium, it's everything that you need because each cell in the body has what's called a sodium-potassium pump, and that regulates the balance of the minerals inside and outside the cells. And so this magnesium really plays a huge part in that. On a side note, the Calm stuff, it's actually made, there's lots of different forms of magnesium, but this one's magnesium carbonate, which is very absorbable, but it's also a carbonate. And there's a lot of interesting discussion about carbonates being very important to the body. So think like sodium bicarbonate. This is magnesium bicarbonate. But sodium bicarbonate is baking soda, and that's a lot of times what people with cancer can take and get rid of the cancer. It's super important to the body. One thing on sodium bicarbonate, if you take sodium bicarbonate, you want to make sure you do not take it on a full stomach. It will screw up your digestion system because it will change the pH and make it too alkaline, and your stomach needs to be acidic in order to have good digestion. So if you take baking soda, if you have a stomach problem, okay, that's what is in Tums, that's what's, you know, typically given, it actually will make your digestion worse. You actually are needing more acid, not less, and that sounds so bizarre, but if you look it up on the web, you'll see that it actually is very effective. So if you take the baking soda, you want to take it on an empty stomach for that reason, because it's very, very alkaline, and your stomach, in order to digest properly, needs to be very, very acidic. That's a good thing for your stomach. All right, so that's a little bit about magnesium and digestion and stuff. You know, I love that stuff. So we'll have little snippets here and there. But I think especially because we get so much muscle cramps, like Jerry was talking about, whether it's in your feet or your hamstrings or like headaches, there's a strong correlation there with the magnesium as well. You want to make sure that your clients are getting enough, and it's real simple. And just not tell them to take a supplement, but you can say, you know, you might want to think about trying this. This might be connected. And just give them some food for thought. Anyways, that's all for tonight. Send me your questions, and I will get to them as quickly as I can in the weeks following. But you guys have been asking some great ones, so I just want to thank you for that.
Thanks for listening to this P3 podcast. If you liked it, please go to iTunes and rate it. You can also subscribe to our program on iTunes so that you don't miss a single episode. I want to leave you with a final message to keep in mind this week. Everyone deserves to enjoy movement, and you're the one that can help them do it.